just like, well, just why not just entertain the possibility that you're not being deceived, and that quite possibly the entire universe was designed by an intelligent designer to support life on Earth. But you could look small, though, too. You don't have to look big. You could look small. A single-cell animal. Okay, a cell is the most basic unit of life, the simplest form of life. But a single-celled animal contains enough genetic information to fill an entire library. Okay? You know, if you had a print shop and you had an infinite number of explosions, you would never, through an explosion, accidentally produce a Webster's Dictionary. Okay? Like the Big Bang model. Supposedly, this Big Bang just exploded everything into existence, and somehow we went from total chaos to order. Okay? Yeah, let's say that television set over there gets 20 channels. Okay? If I blow it up, do you think I'm going to add a 21st or a 22nd channel? Is it going to increase in complexity and order? No. It will go from a state of order and design to total chaos. Okay? So this idea that the Big Bang produced all this order, hey, science is supposed to look for evidence in the world of the senses, and I know of absolutely no example where a random explosion produced order out of chaos rather than chaos out of order. Okay? And so the teleological argument, probably the most famous teleological argument was William Paley, Paley's watchmaker. Well, he argued that if you walked into the wilderness and you found a watch, from examining the watch, even if you never saw a watch before, you would see that it's so complex and so well, so orderly that it had to have an intelligent designer. And then Paley looks at the human eye and talks about the human eye and shows that is a product of intelligent design. I mean, right now we have some scientists that are dealing with genetic research that are now starting to argue that, and some of these guys are atheists, but they're starting to argue that there is more to nature than just matter. That when you look at the genetic code, it is not like an analogous, similar to language. It is its own language. You have the equivalent of letters, of words, of sentences, of paragraphs, okay? And what these guys are now arguing, some of the world's leading geneticists are arguing that we have not just matter, but matter plus a non-material thing called information. Okay? Now, I mean, we are getting real close here to acknowledging the existence of matter and mind, working on that matter and designing it in such a way that, you know, things make sense. And then the idea, you know, we were talking about evolution. Evolutionists try to say that evolution occurred through mutations. Many evolutionists say that a mutation only garbles the already existing genetic code. So if the genetic code of an animal was, let's say, equivalent to the 26 letters of the alphabet, a mutation would not add a 27th or a 28th letter. It would just garble the 26 letters, okay? So basically, you know, Charles Ryrie asked the question, where did single-celled animals get the genetic information for teeth? Or for the color of hair. See, the genetic information is not there. Now, humans at the moment of conception have all the genetic information for the kind of hair, the type of teeth you're going to have, you know, the list goes on and on. But in a single-celled animal, you don't have any of that information. So mutations, you know, can't explain, you know, does not add any new, more complex information. So the teleological argument, the argument for the design of the universe to that of an intelligent designer is a strong argument for God's existence. The possibility of human knowledge or human reason, I would just put here, human reason needs a rational cause. Human reason needs a rational cause. If you had a rational argument and you came and you said, well, I believe this, and we were talking about like Calvinism, and my rejection of Calvinism, and you had, well, why? And so I'd give a reason. And then you could say, well, why about that reason? I have to give another reason and stuff like that. If you can trace in my argumentation, go back from the conclusion to the premises that lead up to it, if you can ever trace it back to an irrational or a non-rational point where it doesn't follow, you've destroyed my argument. Okay? But I think that should hold for all argumentation. If human reason itself can be traced back to an accident that occurred from primordial soup, okay? If reason came from non-reason, then is reason really rational? In the end, it's just a game. And C.S. Lewis argued that reason, the only way that our reason is really a worthwhile enterprise using human reason is if you can trace it back to reason with a capital R. Okay? I think there's a strong argument there. Augustine's argument, number 5, the existence of universal, eternal, unchanging truths. Basically, just write down that they prove the existence of an eternal, unchanging... put down, their source is an eternal, unchanging mind. See, their source is an eternal, unchanging mind. Basically, Augustine said, you know, there's eternal truth. He was a Platonist. He believed that Plato was... Right. By the way, I'm more Augustinian than I am Thomistic. I side more with Augustine and Plato than I do Aquinas and Aristotle on my theory of knowledge. So I would agree with Plato. Now, I disagree with Plato. Plato argued that particular chairs are not ultimately real. Now, as a Christian, God really created a physical universe. So particular chairs are real. So I disagree with Plato there. Augustine disagreed with him. But Plato believed that the ultimately real would be like the eternal unchanging idea chair that all particular chairs share in. Okay? Now, though I believe that particular chairs are really real, okay, they're not eternal, but I do believe that there is an eternal, unchanging idea chair. Now, not all Christian thinkers would agree with me, but follow my reasoning out here, okay? Did some human, at some point in time, was there a human who came up with the first idea chair? Okay? Now, do you think when that guy came up with the idea, let's say the guy's name was Lenny. Lenny comes up with this idea chair, and he's the first guy that invents a chair, and lo and behold, now people can get a little bit more relaxation. You know, before then, it was just you just either on your back sleeping or you were standing. Now he invents a chair. Lenny does a good thing. Do you think God said, oh, wow, man, that blows me away. I never had the idea of a chair. So you see what I'm getting at? If God is, you see, two kinds of beings cannot learn. A total ignoramus, okay, if there were such a thing, total ignoramus, okay, or a being that's not created to learn like a rock, but, an all-knowing being. You see, God can't learn anything in his basic nature. I mean, the incarnation, whole different story there. But God in his basic nature cannot learn anything, because to learn something means you didn't already know it before you learned it. And God always knew everything there is to know through all eternity. An omniscient being, an all-knowing being. So I believe God always had the idea to share. I also believe God knows an infinite number of things. Because if God only knows a finite number of things, then given enough time, given all of eternity, we'll be learning more and more about God throughout all eternity, eventually we'll have them all figured out. We'll know as much as he knows. But with Zeno's paradox, you can never traverse an actual infinite. That means we're going to, throughout all eternity, believers will be learning more and more about God and his creation throughout all eternity. We'll be learning more and more about him, yet we'll never have him fully figured out, which is great for me, because I love learning, and I think it would be pretty boring for a finite being to know everything if that were possible, which is not possible. But whatever the case, Plato believed in the existence of these eternal, unchanging ideas, and he just left them hanging there. Augustine was a Neoplatonist. He held some of Plato's views, and then he converted to Christianity, and he realized those eternal, unchanging ideas make no sense. We can make no sense out of explaining why they're there unless we place them in the eternal, unchanging mind of God. Okay? So Augustine would say the eternal, unchanging truth that 1 plus 1 equals 2, man didn't invent that. Our eternal, changing minds are often judged by the eternal, unchanging truth that 1 plus 1 equals 2. If we add 1 plus 1 and we come up with 3, that truth that stands above our minds stands in judgment of our, you know, and says, no, you did some bad math there. Your answer is wrong. So Augustine says that these are fallible, changing, limited minds cannot account for the existence of eternal, unchanging ideas. We need an eternal, unchanging mind as the cause of eternal, unchanging ideas. Now, number 6, universal, eternal, unchanging moral laws. You just put down that they prove the existence of an eternal, unchanging moral lawgiver. Prove the existence of an eternal, unchanging moral lawgiver. Universal, eternal, unchanging moral laws prove the existence of an eternal, unchanging moral lawgiver. We're going to spend a little bit more time on that one next week. I'll give you my own little, I think I talked about it already, but my own moral argument for God's existence. And then we'll move on to some of these other arguments. And basically, in each one of these, at the beginning of the universe, atheists used to argue that the universe was eternal. And with the second law of thermodynamics established in 1850, and the Big Bang model established pretty much in the early 1920s, and by the late 1920s, the beginning of the universe, atheists should, number one, admit defeat. Say, okay, we thought the universe was eternal, we're wrong. It had a beginning, it does need a cause. But instead of doing that, what they're either they're saying one of two things. Either that, you know, like Carl Sagan, he believed in the oscillating model, even though he openly admitted that all the available scientific evidence is against the oscillating model. But he believed maybe 100 years from now, maybe the oscillating model will be scientifically vindicated. So they either say, well, even though all the scientific evidence is against an eternal universe, I'm going to believe in eternal universe anyway. Or they do what Quentin Smith did, one of the atheism's leading philosophers. In his debate with a friend of mine, William Lane Craig, and, page 135 of Theism, Atheism, and Big Bang Cosmology, he states that the universe popped into existence out of nothing, totally without a cause. Okay. Now, for me, if that were possible, that would totally destroy science. Why seek a scientific explanation when the phenomenon in question could have just popped into existence totally out of nothing, totally without a cause? So it seems that the principle of causality, that every effect must have an adequate cause, if we throw that principle out, all science goes with. And that's what Einstein was talking about when he said God does not play dice with the universe. Because his colleague Heisenberg was trying to argue that on the quantum level, subatomic particle level, things could occur totally without a cause. And Einstein had a problem with that interpretation of quantum physics. But when you look at each and every one of these, theism, if you put theism against any other worldview one at a time, theistic explanation is more plausible. On each one of these, when you add them up, it's got theism written all over it. And so that's why I call it a cumulative case for God's existence. Okay, we'll pick it up there next week. I'm going to try to catch the earlier furry. I don't know if I'm going to make it, but...
Did you miss the 950
last time? Yeah, we went to Dairy Queen, and... It's weird too, because I got moolah today. I didn't have money, so these guys treated me and everything. So, but oh, and then when I let me get